Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, more than 5,000 Florida residents are diagnosed with COVID-19 every day, on average, over the last week. Now, this is the highest number of positive cases since early August, when the state was coming out of another big surge of infections.
Yeah, and according to the latest state data, 4 out of 5 hospital beds in the state have patients in them. More than 3,000 of those beds have a patient suffering from coronavirus in Florida. This virus continues spreading across the state, and local governments are limited in how they may respond in the days and weeks ahead. Governor Ron DeSantis has banned them from closing businesses or enforcing mask mandates.
That's right. There are mandates in places around the state, but really, we're all on the honor system if you're living under one. You won't be penalized if you don't wear that mask. Now, the governor has said his COVID approach is protecting people thought to be most vulnerable. But critics worry the governor's strategy amounts to what's known as herd immunity, just allowing the virus to spread unchecked until a majority of people have had it, and that would slow the infection down. Now, while COVID infections are climbing, the number of people in Florida dying from coronavirus is actually falling, according to the State Department of Health data. But we also need to point out the governor has tried to cast doubt on how some COVID deaths are being classified.
So lots to talk about here this week, beginning with COVID-19 here in the Sunshine State. Infections and hospitalizations are rising across the state. There are few restrictions in place. So what are your concerns about the increase in coronavirus that we're experiencing here just before Thanksgiving? How do you think the state and your local community are handling this pandemic now 9 months into it? 305-995-1800. Statewide phone number open right now, 305-995-1800, or tweet us at Florida Roundup.
Mary Ellen Kloss is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief with the Miami Herald, and she's been covering this. Mary Ellen, great to have you back on the show. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Let's begin with the criticism of the governor. His Democratic opponents in the state and also some public health experts say DeSantis is pursuing a controversial strategy known as herd immunity. Is that accusation correct?
Well, you know, the classic definition of herd immunity is to let a large enough, as you described, let enough people get infected with the virus so that they have built up the antibodies that if encounter the virus, they do not get it. But Florida is far from reaching that point. And so when the governor made his announcement of pretty much no more restrictions, everybody needed to open up, we did not have any of the guardrails in place that you normally would need if you want everybody to be free from getting the virus. So he was open to criticism that his idea was to make sure that, you know, let people get infected. His strategy has been from the beginning to make sure that people who are vulnerable, the elderly, those with other illnesses, they should be the ones that are protected. But when you open up the rest of the state, you've got to be sure that you've got everything in place to protect those people. And the public health experts have said that that's not here. It's not operating in Florida where everybody who is vulnerable is getting protected. And that is the big concern.
And so DeSantis is relying on other advisors and experts for guidance on coronavirus than the public health experts you just mentioned. Who is in his inner circle, and why is this considered controversial?
So the governor has invited some of the kind of some of the scientists and medical professionals who don't necessarily, some of whom do not have an expertise in public health or epidemiology, to advise him. In August, he brought in the White House's advisor, Scott Atlas, Scott Atlas is someone who's been very controversial because he has advocated for saying that masks don't necessarily work. He also has advanced the idea that everything should open up and we just need to protect the vulnerable. He also has brought in, at the end of September, he brought in three other advisors, including two of whom were behind the authors of a document called the Great Barrington Declaration. And that also advanced many of these ideas. They didn't call it herd immunity, but they called it, quote, focus protection. And the idea is that everybody should resume life as normal and just wash your hands and stay at home if you're sick. And then the focus of all of our resources and attention should be going on people who are high risk adults.
And to be clear, your reporting and others have shown that most public health experts feel that's a reckless approach, that will result in more deaths, correct?
Right, right. So it's pretty universally and widely believed that, you know, it's a dangerous idea to go down the path of suggesting that everyone should be able to be infected, because it's just going to lead to more deaths and potentially, you know, first, and if not more deaths, certainly more hospitalizations and crowded hospitals. And you know, that when you look at the numbers, just the raw numbers in Florida, there are probably, according to the cases that we've just recorded, there's about 3.8% of the population that's likely been infected. So if you translate that into the total number of people broadly in the population using these mathematical models, it's probably closer to 19% of the whole population.
That's a much higher
in
number.
In order to reach her, right. So, you know, that would mean that if everybody's been exposed, that's they're potentially immune. But there's a couple problems with that conclusion. We don't know how long immunity lasts if you've been exposed, according to the experts. And then there is just the fundamental issue of you've got to reach about 70% of the population needs to have that immunity in order to reach herd immunity. So just doing the math, if 19% of the population today has been exposed to COVID and may have immunity, and assuming that immunity lasts, we'd have to have three times as many people be infected just to reach a 60% threshold. So that opens the door for a lot more people to get sick. And that's the criticism that the public health experts have said, is that the governor's policy is not on containing and prevention. It's more of an open everything, allow infection approach.
Now, you mentioned masks. This week, the Centers for Disease Control issued new guidelines around mask wearing, saying that not only do they protect people around you, if you wear a mask, you are protecting yourself as well. That's new guideline information for all of us. Theoretically, to get more people to mask up, they're saying there's evidence it will protect you as well as others. At the same time, the governor has appeared maskless in crowded settings multiple times in recent weeks, particularly at rallies in Florida for President Trump. You're reporting in the Miami Herald that the governor considers Trump's win in Florida a vindication of his policies around coronavirus. So given that, how much of the governor's public health approach is being driven by politics?
You know, the governor had been very available and out front in talking about the coronavirus before the election. He held multiple press conferences, you know, at least once a week and often two or more times a week. And he focused on this issue, bringing experts in and traveling across the state. Since the election, the governor hasn't even been, he gave one media availability, and that was for the Weather Channel to talk about the approach of the tropical storm. So it's hard to conclude. It's hard not to conclude that much of his approach to the virus was intended to have a political appeal. And you know, his critics have said that because he, you know, was making Florida be comfortable with getting out there and getting back to work and living your life normally, that was what people wanted to hear. And so that strategy was very effective in, you know, advancing where things ended up on election day.
Mary Ellen, stick with us. Mary Ellen Kloss is with us, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times Miami Herald, talking about the coronavirus, COVID-19, the state of the germ here in Florida, as we're 2 weeks or so away from Thanksgiving. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. Infection rates have been climbing across the state. Hospitalizations also have been increasing. Justin Senior is back with us. He's the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. Justin, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks again for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
What are Safety Net hospitals experiencing now with COVID-19 patients throughout the state?
Well, there has been a bit of a bump in the number of COVID patients over the last several weeks. It is not yet at anywhere near the level that it was back in July. Hospitalizations peaked back in July in terms of the number of patients in Florida who were in the hospital with a primary diagnosis of COVID. It peaked at just under 10,000 patients. 60,000 hospital beds in the state peaked at about 10,000 patients back in July. It was extremely heavy volume in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Lee counties, as well as Palm Beach. So it was very concentrated in South Florida at that time. Right now, the numbers are at about 3,100 to 3,200. So it's quite a bit lower than it was then, but it's 1,000 patients higher than it was about a week or two ago. So we are seeing a bump. We're seeing an increase, as you guys mentioned on the show earlier, in the number of infections that are being identified each day. It's now over 5,000 on average for the last week. And we're also seeing a slight increase in the positivity rate. For a number of weeks there in September and October, we actually had gotten it as a state underneath 5%, which is indicative of a pretty well-controlled infection rate. But unfortunately, it's now up closer to about 7 or 8. It's not at 10%, so it's not yet at alarming levels, but the increase is enough, I think, to be concerned. And this is something that we're seeing that hospitals really have to be ready for.
Yeah,
Justin, let's talk
about that preparation here. As you mentioned, the hospitalizations for COVID, only a third of what they were during the summertime surge, but they're up 40-50% in just the past 10 or 12 days or so. So a pretty significant uptick in a relatively short period of time. So what preparations are happening now?
So, you know, at this point, I can say that hospitals, fortunately or unfortunately, are very familiar with this particular pandemic and have protocols in place to help control the infections, to help identify patients as they come in as COVID patients, whether they're presenting at the hospital for COVID or not. You really have to have protocols in place. If someone's been in a car accident or someone's coming in to give birth, you have to be able to identify whether that person has COVID or not. So the testing capability tends to be there. The supply chains have improved so that the personal protective equipment tends to be there. And all of the training is in place now. So hospitals should be much better prepared for it.
What about the elasticity, though, of the bed capacity? There's the census bed capacity, in other words, the licensed bed capacity of these medical facilities. There's the staffed bed capacity, so how many nurses and technicians and doctors are available to actually be able to treat the patients who are in the bed. And then, of course, there's the overflow capacity. We saw this in the summertime with some of these field hospitals being set up. So what is that elasticity in the capacity as you're seeing, again, you know, a 30-40% increase in hospitalizations in 2 weeks?
Yeah. So we're not there yet. There are a number of different strategies that hospitals can use to try to create capacity, to free up capacity, to make sure that they can handle a surge. And what we saw in South Florida, for example, and you referenced it back in July, is that you can start to do things like postponing scheduled procedures. These are medically necessary procedures, so you're going to have to do them. But you can potentially get away with postponing a hip replacement or a knee replacement for 4 to 6 weeks to free up staff and to free up space. In Florida's Division of Emergency. Processes are political. He has a registered Democrat, a former Democratic member of the House of Representatives in charge of his emergency management operation. And one of the things that I think has worked really well in Florida is as patients start to come into a hospital, and we saw this in South Florida, they can start to pile up. And that is to say patients can actually become stabilized, but you can't discharge them yet because they live in a retirement community or they live in a nursing home or they live in an assisted living facility and they're still COVID positive. And you can't send them back to that facility and potentially expose all of the residents of that facility to this, what is for elderly, a very dangerous virus.
Yeah. We could debate the politics versus the policies and procedures and the protective gear, certainly. But back to the hospitals, Justin, and the safety net hospitals that are, you know, bedrock in so many of our communities in terms of providing the first level or perhaps the last level of care, that because they're called safety nets after all. Mentioned the issue. Safety net hospitals, though, to revert back to those restrictions on elective surgeries in order to make
decision. And ultimately, that's going to be a capacity decision that each individual hospital has to make. There are a lot of different things there that come into play. One is you've got a certain number of staff members and you have a certain number of beds. Got really tricky was that with all of the infection protocols that you have in place at the hospital, your hospital employees still live in the community.
Right.
And as protected as they were at the hospital, when they would go home, when they would go to the grocery store, when they would go about their lives, they would actually catch coronavirus in the community.
Yeah.
And I'll give Jackson as an example. Hundreds of employees were knocked offline.
Right.
And that actually reduced the Jackson looked nominally like it has a 600-bed capacity, but it could probably only staff about 1,300 to 1,400 at one point.
Justin, we have just it's significant concern, the staffing and the virus. We have just 30 seconds left here, but can the safety net hospital system handle the trajectory of cases if herd immunity is the unofficial strategy?
You know, I'm not sure if it's the unofficial or official strategy, but I can tell you that we were able to hang on and handle it over the summer.
Okay.
I do believe that we have the ability to handle it going forward. We're not hoping for it.
Justin, understood. Yeah. We have to leave it there. Apologies for the interruption. Time is always tight here. Justin Senior is the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida. Justin, thanks again for joining us here on the Florida Roundup.
Thank you for having me.
305-995-1800. We see you on the line. We're going to get to your phone calls in just a matter of moments. 305-995-1800. Stick with us here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Kyle Lamb does not have professional data analysis or public health experience, but he was offered a job as a data analyst with the state of Florida. Lamb blogged about college sports in Ohio, is an Uber driver and hosts a subscriber-only podcast on the coronavirus. And that's where he wrote that he's not an expert or a doctor or an epidemiologist or a scientist. I don't need to be, he said on that site. He has peddled in COVID-19 conspiracy theories, however.
Now, almost all of Florida's Democratic congressional delegation has called on Governor DeSantis to rescind his job offer for Kyle Lamb. The governor's office tells the Miami Herald Lamb is not a COVID-19 hire per se. His job offer comes after Florida COVID-19 death certificates were leaked to a conservative blogger, even as the state hasn't publicly released information about the spread of the virus to researchers and journalists. Getting all of your calls and tweets out there, we'll go to them in a moment. The number to join us is 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. And as we continue with Mary Ellen Kloss, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, I think it's fair to say the tweets we're getting already are incendiary about the governor's handling of COVID. We'll get a few of them on the air in a moment. But first, what's the rationale that you're hearing from the DeSantis administration for hiring Kyle Lamb?
Well, they have described it as he's a pretty low-level official. I think he's making a entry-level salary of about $40,000 in the governor's Office of Management and Budgeting. They're a data analysis shop. But the job description, according to Kyle, or Mr. Lamb, is that this was to work on COVID data. Now, the COVID data is normally in the Department of Health. So why the governor's office would need to do it differently is a big question. However, we do know that the governor's office is somewhat unhappy with the way the Department of Health's death data has been reported. And because of that, all these things fit together to raise more questions about what is the governor's goal here.
Let me ask you as a follow-up, what is going on with the release of data, COVID data in Florida? The governor is releasing data to a conservative blogger amidst continuing complaints that the rest of the people that need to see the data aren't getting full transparency. What's to account for all this?
Well, so this stems back a couple of months. Back in August, the medical examiners, who are the people that do the official death certificates of all deaths, were so inundated with doing the certification of deaths because of COVID, that they asked if they could just have hospitals, doctors and medical professionals at hospitals could sign off on death certificates and then send them directly to the Department of Health. When the medical examiners were doing all the compilation of this data, they would put out a report and then academics and the media could have access to the report, and we could find out we could connect the dots on what trends were happening in COVID deaths. Once the Department of Health started taking over this death data, they refused to release any of that information anymore to academics and the media. And so we have been asking for it ever since. Meanwhile, they are reporting the total number of deaths. So the governor's office has been suggesting that some of these deaths people are being labeled as a COVID death when they died because they had COVID, but they're suggesting that because they had COVID and maybe also died of a heart attack, it should be labeled not as a COVID death, but as another cause of death. So they felt that the COVID deaths have been inflated, but public health experts say that's a distinction without a difference. If you die with COVID, it is a COVID death.
Thanks for clarifying that. Lots of tweets. Here's just one. The governor's not handling the pandemic. Stop analyzing a response that doesn't exist. And Tom, that gives you a sense of the tone of some of the feedback we're getting on the program.
Yeah, arguably there is a response. It's just the lack thereof, right, that tweeter there is obviously responding to. Beth in St. Pete, you are up on the telephone. Thanks for holding on, Beth. You're on the radio.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My concern is, in addition to everything that you said about his lack of really handling this well for the people of this state, it's the economy. You know, we are a state that depends so heavily on tourism and hospitality. You would think it would be in the best interest of our state from an economic perspective to flatten the curve so people are going to feel safe to come here. I mean, look at what happened with Disney, Universal, and they had to lay off so many employees. I would love to see the media do some stories about the cost of this virus, the cost on the economy every week, how much money we're losing, the cost on our healthcare system. I mean, who pays? When you go, when you have a virus and you have to go to the hospital, who covers that? What if you don't have great insurance? I mean, the governor, you know, I'm sure he has fabulous healthcare insurance paid for, you know, by us. Mm-hmm. But, like, it just seems very short-sighted in terms of the overall economic impact that this virus has on our economy.
Yeah, Beth, I mean, the costs are enormous, right? I mean, we still see thousands, tens of thousands of Floridians filing for unemployment each and every week for the first time. We continue to see the unemployment rate is two or three times what it was a year ago, even though it's not at the height that we saw back in the springtime. As you mentioned, you know, tourism and hospitality is operating, you know, on half a leg, if that, to some degree. We've seen some of the passenger numbers in our big airports have just bottomed. Hotel occupancy, I can tell you, in Miami-Dade County is 40%. The average rate room, the average rate that the hoteliers are collecting per available room is like $50, $60 for a hotel room in South Florida.
Those yeah. are the stories that I would like to see the media start, because if the economy and money is the only thing that the governor really cares about and his followers, then I think we need to start seeing some stories about what the numbers are around the cost, including the health care cost and the tourism cost.
Yeah.
And let me just say, you know, I live in St. Pete. I have a Democratic mayor, and he has been fabulous, yet he's constantly gets pushback from people here, and it's so disheartening.
Beth, thanks so much for joining us. Beth in St. Pete here on the Florida Roundup.
We're talking about the cost of COVID and the way the governor's administration has handled the virus in Florida. On the Florida Roundup right now, it's 305-995-1800 to give us a call. And lots of tweets coming in. Here's one more from Kevin. Any analysis other than the epic failure of so-called leadership is not based in reality, he says. Mark in Jacksonville is on the phone. Hi, Mark. How are you? Go ahead.
Hello. Hi. Well, I just wanted to comment. When we closed the businesses early in March, some of the businesses could have stayed open, like department stores. I'm not a shopper, but you could easily wear a mask, go into a department store. There are businesses that could have been open, but we weren't believing in the science about wearing the masks and keeping the distance. And I think now the message should be for those people who don't believe that masks are helpful or that the social distancing is helpful, we ought to just bluntly say either believe in the science, wear your mask, keep your distance, watch yourself, or you could get this thing and you could die. I worked in a precinct over this election, and there was one person who came into the precinct without a mask. And we had plenty of equipment. We had masks, we had wipes, we had disinfectant. And we asked him, would he like a mask? Would he like wipes? Would he like disinfectant? And he was belligerent. He went nuts. He thought we were going to stop him from voting if he didn't put a mask on. So if he wanted to die or if he wanted to get sick, I think that's the message. If we're worried about the businesses, and we are, we should just get the message out. Let's be safe. Let's follow the science. And we can keep some of the businesses open as long as if you go to a restaurant, wear the mask.
Mark, thank you so much. Yeah. Absolutely. Mark in Jacksonville talking about the fact, this is a fact, Mary Ellen Kloss. We know that widespread mask wearing saves lives. We also, as you've been reporting so wonderfully in the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times, that some municipalities around the state have set up mask mandates. They aren't universal, though. We don't have a mandate everywhere. So depending on wherever you're going around the state, you may be around a bunch of masked people, you may not. And then not only that, the governor has overridden local municipalities' efforts to protect their cities or counties by saying that none of these mandates have any enforcement capability. And so that really, it flies in the face of CDC guidelines. The CDC just coming out again, as we said this week, saying the more people that can wear a mask, the more we will all be protected, and that you're protecting yourself as well as others if you follow these guidelines. And so why do you think the governor continues so stridently to resist this public health advice that we know will save lives in this state?
I think we lost Mary Ellen.
Mary Ellen Kloss. I wasn't sure if you could hear.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, there she is.
Could you hear me?
Hi, Mary Ellen. Go ahead.
I am really sorry about that. I just wanted to tell you that we've asked the governor pointedly what he, in his belief, is if you can't socially distance, you can wear a mask. You should wear a mask. But he hasn't modeled that behavior. At every one of the Trump rallies, he never wore a mask. And many of the people in the crowd didn't. He is not preventing local governments from having mask mandates. He's just preventing the enforcement of it, and that does allow for, you know, some communities to be stricter than others. But Florida is a little bit like where we are in the nation. We've got a very decentralized approach to these policies, and there is no universal message. And because of that, I think it's right for people to feel very confused and self-righteous when they disagree with something.
You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We're talking about COVID-19, the coronavirus. Case counts are climbing in Florida. Hospitalizations also are on the increase. Justin Senior is still with us. He is the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Alliance here in the state. Justin, you heard a caller earlier, Beth, in St. Petersburg, ask about healthcare costs. He was asking about the overall kind of economic impact of coronavirus, and it has been substantial in Florida. But what about the cost of providing coronavirus healthcare on the insurance side, but also on the uninsured or underinsured side, which is the population that your safety net hospitals primarily serve? Justin, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
There you go.
We are only 14 systems in the state, 30 total hospitals or so out of 250 plus. So we're a very small percentage of the hospitals, but we've seen nearly 60%.
Small percentage of the hospitals, yes, but a large percentage of hospital beds.
Yep. Not just that, but also nearly 60% of the COVID patients in the state. So we really have been on the front lines here. And it gives a lot of perspective of the cost associated with this. Once you've identified a patient that has COVID, the amount of personal protective equipment and the protocols that have to be followed and putting that patient into an airborne infection isolation room, these are things that are incredibly expensive. We are fortunate that at the federal level, one of the relief bills allowed for Medicare patients to get an increase in the rate if there's a positive test for COVID. That doesn't actually flow through to other programs or commercial insurance necessarily. So some of these costs are being borne by our facilities, and certainly not for the uninsured. These costs are being borne, by the facilities in an effort to get the best public outcome that they possibly can. But it's an extremely expensive and difficult environment. The tests are expensive, and then the protocols, once someone tests positive, are extremely costly.
Let's go to Kate in Newberry. Hi, Kate. Thanks for holding. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Hi. I have a question about the herd immunity strategy. And when they say they're going to refocus the resources onto the vulnerable, can anybody clarify, like, what exactly do they mean by that? Because if they're increasing the community spread, and it depends on more and more people in the community getting the virus, how exactly would they be able to protect the vulnerable under those circumstances?
Yeah, thanks for that, Kate. Mary Ellen Kloss, how is the governor laying out his rationale by saying that his approach will protect the most vulnerable. It does seem to fly in the face of what we know from talking to data scientists and epidemiologists about this, how to fight this disease. Mary Ellen, are you there?
Yep, sorry about that.
Go ahead.
I have to give the governor credit because he has been focused on sending resources to elder care facilities. The federal government bought up all the rapid tests for COVID testing and allocated them to the states. And Florida got a very ample amount of those tests, and the governor has directed them to go to every nursing home and ALF, and then all senior housing, like condominiums and senior communities, and those places are now have access to rapid tests so that staff and residents and visitors can be tested quickly. That does seem to be one way to protect the vulnerable. But what they don't get at is Florida, there's so many people who are not in these isolated senior centers that live in the community. They're multi-generational homes. Other things. And the state just hasn't figured out a way how to identify those people and to protect them. So that is why the experts were saying this is a policy without guardrails.
A policy without guardrails. And we're going to continue in just a moment discussing your COVID questions across Florida. Give us a call now, 305-885-1800. It's the Florida Roundup. Tweet us at Florida Roundup. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening and supporting public media and your community. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Lots of you waiting on hold as we talk about the state's response to coronavirus. We're just a couple of weeks out from Thanksgiving. Public health experts are warning all of us not to gather with big groups over the holidays, to continue maintaining protocols like mask wearing and social distancing. Virus cases are rising once again. It's 305-995-1800. Billy is in Orlando. Hi, Billy. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're saying that the virus is causing an economic downturn, but I believe it's the rules. It's the social distancing. It's the masks. It's the shutdowns that's caused that. If we went back to business as usual, we wouldn't have this economic problems.
All right, Billy, thanks. Justin Senior, you're the CEO of Safety Net Hospital Alliance of Florida, still with us here on the show. You know, the two biggest concerns people have right now are the economy and the virus, and they are interlinked. And so I know you're a public health expert, but let me just ask you to put on another hat for a minute and talk about how you see the restrictions that we've all had to live under for months now affecting the economy. And, you know, people certainly have questions about how this is going to work next year. Will we see a change? Will we finally see our way to the end of dealing with this virus? Will we ever have what we consider to be normal life once we get through this whole crisis?
Yeah, I don't envy policymakers around the country as they try to deal with this, because it really is difficult. I can tell you our hospitals are nonprofit. They're often public. They take anyone, regardless of their ability to pay. And during the economic shutdown, certainly you saw a lot of economic, in terms of the economic numbers, the unemployment rate going higher, lost income, things like that. Our hospitals were seeing quite a spike in opioid overdoses. They were seeing domestic violence increases. They were seeing increases in suicide attempts. There's a real difficult situation here where we have to try to deal with this very deadly virus, try to get it under control, and balance that with the overall healthcare needs and economic needs of the community. And again, I don't envy policymakers around the country having to wrestle with these issues. But it's one of those things where it's complex as opposed to complicated. It's not really, there's no real right answer. You have to try to find the right balancing point, and that works best for your community, and kind of let things rest there. And I don't know that there are any right answers. It's just an extremely difficult situation. And that vaccine, oh my goodness, if that vaccine is 90% effective and we can get that thing distributed to the most vulnerable and start to really move forward, I think we all need to really be hoping and praying for that.
Yes.
In the coming 12 months.
We sure do.
Let's
yeah.
squeeze in some more calls here. West Palm Beach, Bruce, you are up next. Go ahead, Bruce.
Okay. Am I live? I guess.
You are live across the state. Go ahead.
Okay. I've looked at data from the Center for Disease Control website. People under the age of 15 have had less than 100 deaths across the whole country, across this whole 9 months. The older the people get, the more the deaths there are. But people under the age of 45 have had less than 3% of all the deaths in the country, and they represent 60% of the population. That's everybody under 45. Mm-hmm. They ought to be going to school, working, doing whatever. No masks, no nothing. They'll all catch a mild case of the flu, and very, very, very few of them will die. The people over 65 are only 20% of the population. They've had 60% of the deaths.
Yeah.
And they ought to be locking themselves up and not.
Bruce, we know that the older you are and the more underlying conditions one has, the more vulnerable you are to the virus and the more vulnerable you are to not having a good outcome when catching the virus. But under your scenario, how do you protect the 80-year-old grandmother who's living with the 15-year-old grandson?
That is an unusual condition. As a general rule, you should tell everybody over the age of 65 to avoid contact with any younger people. Okay? Wear
right.
masks if you have to.
Bruce, I hear you. We got just a short period of time here, but I appreciate you walking us through your thoughts there. Bruce in West Palm Beach. Mary Ellen, the governor, Governor DeSantis, has focused, he says, his efforts on the most vulnerable, on the nursing home population, on the critical care population. How does he strike that balance, the governor, that Bruce is putting voice to?
Well, the governor sounds a lot like Bruce. He makes the same argument that people who are younger are less inclined to have serious illness or death. The disconnect, of course, comes with, you know, if you live in a college town and there's a lot of young people getting infected and they go to a restaurant and they don't wear a mask and you sit next to them.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't put those barriers up, how do you protect people?
Yeah. Mary Ellen Klaus, stick with us here. We got to talk a little bit about presidential politics here in a moment. But Justin Senior, I want to thank you again for your time. Justin Senior, the CEO of the Safety Net Hospital Association here in the state of Florida. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio.
Well, we just had an election. You might have noticed. No statewide elected Republican in Florida as yet has even acknowledged Joe Biden as the president-elect of the United States. Now, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is the most prominent Florida Republican to issue a statement. Of course, though, Bush is out of office. Here is Republican Senator Marco Rubio on Tuesday.
Our election laws call for recounts in close elections. They provide candidates the right to contest votes cast in violation of the law. They allow the right to present evidence of fraud, if you have it, to present that evidence in court.
Now, courts have rejected almost all of the Trump campaign's lawsuits that have been filed. No evidence of voter fraud. Florida's election results, meantime, will be certified next week on Tuesday. That's the schedule. At Florida Roundup is our Twitter handle. Mary Ellen Klaus still with us, Capitol Bureau Chief at the Miami Herald. Have any prominent state Republicans here in Florida come out acknowledging that the former Vice President, Joe Biden, is the president-elect of the United States?
Well, I haven't spoken to any, and I have put a lot of calls out to pretty much everybody in leadership. It's been pretty silent.
Yeah, you know, Mary Ellen, Francis Rooney, the congressman who's retiring, as far as I can tell, he's the only Republican office holder anywhere in the state who has acknowledged Biden's victory. And so what are your thoughts about those watching this who feel that the governor, Rick Scott, Marco Rubio, that they all have presidential aspirations and that they want Donald Trump's support here in Florida and around the country? If they're planning to run for president in 2024, is that what's driving their reluctance to acknowledge the reality that Joe Biden won the election?
I think more than Donald Trump, I think they're interested in Donald Trump's base. And they are very they see that he has an energized base, people who are they need to turn out and need to align, have them align with them. We've watched, that's why, you know, so many Republicans are flocking to Georgia because there are these two U.S. Senate seats on the line. It's going to be the most, the biggest runoff election we've ever seen in American history. And everybody that is showing up there is trying to appeal to a national base of Trump voters and keep them energized. I don't think that is any different here in Florida. And it's a rational calculation. And it's just the question is, how will that turn out? You know, the latest reporting we have is that that Donald Trump is, if he loses, or, you know, he has lost, but he is now considering running again in 4 years.
Right.
That will upset the prospects for all of Florida's top leaders.
Yeah, the political matrix gets turned upside down, turned around, flipped on its head, and turned inside out, if that's the case. Jane is our last caller here. Jane, go ahead. You're on the radio.
Hi. My question is, what can we do as citizens of Florida to prompt the governor and to prompt people that the election is over, it's done, and really the choice is Trumpism, the Democrats, or the GOP? How do we get people to see there's really three things going on? Because I've been a Democrat, a Republican, and an independent, and this is really affecting our lives and our public health. What can I do to change
things? Jane, I appreciate the call there. Mary Ellen, what about for Florida voters, regardless of how they voted in the election? Do they still have a voice in these days and weeks ahead?
Well, I'm a big advocate of people reaching out to their elected officials and telling people what they think. We are about to embark on a organizational session of the legislature next week. It's on Tuesday. Florida is one of seven states that hasn't addressed its legislature, hasn't convened in to address anything related to the coronavirus.
Right.
These legislators don't feel as if the public expects them to do it. So only when people talk to their legislators will they respond,
yeah,
and their elected officials.
That planning session happens this coming week. And on Tuesday, again, the Florida presidential vote is due to be certified. Mary Ellen, always great to spend an hour with you. Thanks so much for sharing your reporting with all of us.
Thanks, Tom and Melissa. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone who called us and tweeted us from across the state here on the Florida Roundup. By WJCT Public Media in Jax, WLRN in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are our producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. Director of Radio Operations at WLRN is Peter Meritz. He's also our technical director. Engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Richard Ives answers the phones. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday at noon.